Films in Focus with David Sterrett is underwritten by The Movie House, your destination for first-run Hollywood and independent movies, and a digital portal to the Met Opera, National Theater Live, and special events worldwide in Millerton, New York, and on the web, themoviehouse.net.
David Sterrett is the editor-in-chief of the Quarterly Review of Film and Video, contributing writer at Cineast, film professor at the Maryland Institute College of Art, Robin Hood Radio's very own critic. He joins us weekly. The films are The Conductor, The Olive Trees of Justice, The Worst Person in the World, and I have been informed reliably that this is a festival of definite articles.
That's what it is. If you thought there was no more excitement in the movie world, well, here we have three movies which are all out right now and which all begin with the definite article, the. So, anyway, aside from that, the movies have really very little in common, which is okay with me. It's a nice varied week. So I'd like to start by talking about The Conductor. These days I live in Baltimore, and in about 6 or 7 minutes, I can walk to the Joseph Meyerhoff Symphony Hall and see the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra. And I'm a subscriber to that orchestra, and I have been for many years. And the conductor, the music director, the honcho, the artistic honcho of that outfit for many years, most of my years of living here, was Marin Alsop. And The Conductor is a documentary all about Marin Alsop. It's sort of a biodoc. It tells the story of her background and her life and her time at the Baltimore Symphony and so forth. Now, what's interesting, well, quite a number of things are interesting about Marin Alsop. But the most obvious interesting thing about her is that she became, some years ago, the very first woman to be the conductor, not just a conductor or a sometime conductor, but the official conductor of a major American symphony orchestra. Yes, the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra is a major American orchestra, and she, when she became the conductor of that, she became the first woman to ever hold that position with any major American orchestra, which is really, really something, and which is really, really disgraceful, because it should have happened long before that. And on top of that, she remained the only woman to be the conductor of a major symphony orchestra, and now she is leaving the Baltimore Symphony. She's still conducting a little bit. In fact, I saw her just this past Sunday conducting a concert, but she's sort of fading out of view with the Baltimore Symphony, which is too bad because she's a good conductor. In any case, that is what The Conductor is about, and it tells the story of her life, and especially about, to use a real cliche here, about how she managed to break the glass ceiling for being a female conductor and how really difficult that was. And oh my gosh, it's got the stories in it about how this teacher said, oh, you can never be a conductor, you're a woman. And that teacher said, well, maybe you can conduct, but you'll never do anything major. And that kind of thing. And she faced that kind of stuff all during her years of coming up the ladder. So what she did was, along the way, and the movie is very, very entertaining in the way it illustrates all of this, she really took the initiative. She says more than once in the film, the film suffers a bit from repetition, I'm afraid. But she says more than once that the word can't is something she's never been able to accept. She thinks it's the worst four-letter word in the English language. And so when she wasn't allowed to do things, she would figure out ways of doing them. So when she was quite young, for example, she started her own swing band. She started a mostly strings band that played like jazz because she thought that would be a way of conducting and, well, of leading a group at least without having an orchestra to conduct. And so she did that, and she started it, and they were quite successful. And then later on in her career, quite a bit later on, she started her own actual orchestra called the Concordia Orchestra, around 50 members, and they did a bunch of performing and recording and so forth and so on. So she did stuff like that. Then she did become the conductor of the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra, and yep, there were problems there too. I remember when this was happening. Some of the orchestra members complained, and they didn't like the way she did things, and some people said, said, and this is something that faced her at various times in her career, that it was distracting to see a woman up on the podium, that it wasn't right somehow. And, they would look at her body instead of her hands, and it took attention away from the, you know, awful, awful, preposterous stuff like that she had to face throughout her whole career. And so you get to see a lot of that in The Conductor, the movie, and it's pretty interesting and sometimes pretty harrowing, but my gosh, she really has triumphed over so much of that stuff. It's a very, very upbeat film. I almost said offbeat. It's not offbeat at all. It's a very conventional documentary directed by Bernadette Wegenstein. But it tells the story nicely. It also gives you some insights into Alsop's personal life. She has a spouse, a woman she has lived with for many a year. They have a son, a little boy. And so, you know, you get a little bit of that along the way in the movie as well. And again, it's just a very, very nicely, conventionally done movie that gives you the whole story. Something the movie does not discuss, and I think this is a real failing in the movie, is that Marin Alsop is now leaving the Baltimore Symphony, and it is not an entirely pleasant experience. There were tensions, there were frictions that never quite went away, and some of it has to do with her ambitions. She did a lot of stuff besides just conducting the orchestra. I mean, really a lot of very major stuff. For example, she started a really important music program for young kids. Baltimore is a poor city, has a lot of underprivileged people, and she started a program called OrKids, which is a music program for kids, stuff like that. Really very, very nice. But she had other ambitions. She wanted to start sort of a music district in Baltimore, not far from where I live, not far from where the symphony performs. And that was too ambitious, and it took attention away from the orchestra and distracted her and distracted a lot of the people who support her. And so this stuff the movie never gets into and discusses, and so it's kind of unfortunate. She is leaving the Baltimore Symphony now in not an entirely pleasant way, and the movie just does not discuss that at all. However, it is a very, very positive, very upbeat picture of how one woman managed to conquer the sexism in the music industry and the music scene and the classical music scene. And it's a very, I really had a good time watching it. And not only because I live just around the corner from where the Baltimore Symphony performs. Next film today, Jill, is so, so different. The Olive Trees of Justice. And this is actually a French film. The French title is Les Oliviers de la Justice. And this is a movie from way back in 1962. And it was directed by a very unusual filmmaker named James Blue. And this is the only time James Blue made a fictional film. He mainly made documentaries, and he was very politically oriented. And The Olive Trees of Justice is based on a novel, and it was shot in Algeria during the Algerian War, and it deals with that, and it's a fascinating movie. And the reason I'm talking about a movie from way back in 1962 is that it has just been restored and is being re-released theatrically, so people have an opportunity to see it, and it's a wonderful, wonderful movie. So here's a little bit about it. Okay, it is the story of a young man who left Algiers, where he grew up and where his parents owned a farm, and his father is now dying, and so he comes back from France to Algeria to see his dying father and spend time with him and reconnect with his mother and all of this. But mainly, once his father dies, he plans to go right back to France, right back to Paris. He has no interest in being in Algeria anymore. So it is really a very human drama about this young man and his returning to Algeria, and that brings back all sorts of memories, and we have a lot of memories of his childhood in various flashbacks. The movie is full of flashbacks to his childhood, which apparently was a pretty happy childhood, and he had a couple of very close young friends, and they're still around, interestingly, and that's an important aspect of the movie, because one of those childhood friends has now become a revolutionary, and the other childhood friend is now working in the family home as a servant. So very, very different experiences, and so our young man, our main character, reconnects with both of them, again, while remembering his childhood experience and contrasting it with the way things are now in Algeria. So again, this movie was made in 1962, which is very much when Algeria was still fighting desperately for its independence from France. We are dealing with the old age of colonialism, and colonialism has not disappeared, but this is back when countries were really very proud of having their colonies and did not want to relinquish relinquish their colonies as much as the colonies wanted their freedom. So this movie, 1962, The Algerian War, that is the fight for freedom from France, is still very much going on. Now, it's in the background of this movie, because what we may have in our character in this movie is our main character, Jean, returning back to his family to visit his father and comfort him in his declining days and reconnect with memories and stuff like that. And it's not about the war for independence, but the war for independence is very much going on. And as I mentioned, one of those childhood friends is now a revolutionary fighting in that war for independence. And so what we have here is really a very personal story, but with the background, and it's not the far background of this war, which is raging all around. Every once in a while, there's gunfire that bursts out. People get killed, stuff like that. But, you know, we see this the way it probably was very much in real life that time in Algeria. What we see is people coming out in the morning saying, what was that gunfire last night? What was that gunfire? What happened? And then maybe you find out a little bit and the police come around and they're investigating something. But it's not like, it's not the center of everybody's lives. It's just always, always there. And of course, what we now know is that ultimately that struggle for freedom from France was successful. And that's a very good thing, of course. But here we have it while it's going on. But we see it in a movie reflected in a very personal way by this young man who is mainly just involved with his family, and the war is just going on all around. But for the filmmaker, James Blue, again, a very political filmmaker, that is really what is crucial about this movie. And he's really, really interested in getting across what's going on and the real life experiences of these people while we have this, this terrible struggle going on all around them. So again, The Olive Trees of Justice is an old movie made back in the early 60s, but that's one of the things I love about it. It has that look and feel of the French New Wave films of that era, and of the Italian neorealist films, just from slightly earlier in that era. There are a lot of non-professional performers in this movie. It's not a movie full of movie stars. We have people who really know how to act alongside people who are just acting characters very much like themselves and don't have any real formal training in acting, and that makes them all the more realistic, all the more persuasive, all the more authentic. Everything about this movie is authentic. Shot on location, we see real places, we see real things, we see real people. I found The Olive Trees of Justice to be just a fascinating movie and a beautiful movie to watch. I totally recommend it. Seek it out. A movie from way back in the early 60s and really very urgent and fascinating to look at today. And our final film today, Jill, The Worst Person in the World. Imagine my disappointment when I found out that this movie isn't about me. Because that's how I think of myself. But hey, it turns out there are other worse people in the world. And this is a movie directed by a very, very fine filmmaker named Joachim Trier. This is actually the third part. He's a Norwegian filmmaker. And this is really the third part of a trilogy, which is often called his Oslo trilogy. But it's a totally standalone film. All three of these movies are standalone movies. The first one in the Oslo trilogy was called Reprise, made back in 2006, which is the story of two young writers who are friends and also rivals with each other. And then a movie called Oslo, August 31st, which came out in 2011, which is a very, very dark-toned story of a young man who is drifting inexorably in the direction of suicide. And now we have the third in the Oslo trilogy, The Worst Person in the World, except for the fact that all three of these movies feature the really, really gifted young actor Anders Danielsen Lie, except for that they're all very, and they take place in Oslo, they're all very separate stories, so you can certainly jump right into The Worst Person in the World without having seen any of the earlier films, and you won't have any troubles at all. This is basically a story that is centered on a woman played by an actress named Renata Reinsva. She has won, by the way, various awards for her portrayal. It's an excellent one. And the movie just follows various incidents over a few years in her life. And we find out at the beginning she's not sure what she wants to do with her life. At one point she wants to be a physician and she's in medical school. Then she decides she wants to be a psychologist and then she's studying psychology. Then she wants to be a photographer. She gravitates toward the arts, and along the way during all of this, she gets involved with various men, one of whom is played by Anders Danielsen Lie, and another one is whom played by another actor, and they're very different kinds of men, and she gets involved with one, and then that overlaps with the other, and there are the usual troubles that people have when they try to balance more than one serious love affair, and she lives with one of these men, and then with another one, and that's the way the movie goes. Eventually, this movie, which is largely a comedy, gets into very dark territory where one of the main characters gets mortally ill. But it's a very upbeat film. It's a very beautiful film to look at. It has a fabulous performance by Renata Reinspa and a wonderful performance by Anders Danielsson-Lea. One of the fascinating things about him is that he is not only a really, really busy Norwegian actor who appears in the leading roles in very major films, he's also a practicing physician himself. What an overachiever. It's really always wonderful to see him because he's a terrific, terrific actor. The Worst Person in the World is a little bit longer than I think it should be as well, over 2 hours long, but it's really involving, engrossing. It has comedy, it has drama, it has a bit of tragedy in it, and above all, it has wonderful acting and wonderful, just lucid filmmaking by the terrifically gifted Joachim Trier. So I really recommend all three of today's films, Jill, but The Worst Person in the World is perhaps the most sheerly enjoyable of the bunch, and I hope people seek it out. It shows that really good art movies are being made in the world, and they are entertaining as well. So that is my international story this week.
Thank you for being so definite. David Sterrett, Films in Focus, The Films, The Conductor, The Olive Trees of Justice, and The Worst Person in the World.